Okay, hi everybody, and welcome again to our continuing work on the rules of magic for the physical plane. And we are on program number 5, we're on the 13th rule, and we've come to that point where we're going to be dealing with the precipitation of thought forms. So let's see if I can get everything lined up here in the proper manner. We have just finished working, I think, a very interesting section on the potencies produce precipitation. That's sort of a summary statement, a general statement which DK has offered with that triple P mnemonic. He often does that, you know, to help us understand more clearly. And basically, he's talking about the descent of the idea from the thinker who controls the potency and its quality into the brain and the physical plane for precipitation. All right. Now, let's venture into this question of the precipitation of thought forms. Okay. DK says, what is a precipitation? Maybe we all have our own idea about that. You know, certainly a condensation and a denser materialization. Many definitions could be given, and most of them, being clothed in words, would lose much of their true significance, but some idea may be conveyed in the following terms. It seems that in some of this material we've been working with, Master DK is not particularly fond of the limiting tendencies of words. A precipitation is an aggregation of energies arranged in a certain form in order to express the idea of some creative thinker, and qualified or characterized by the nature of his thought, and held in that peculiar form as long as his thought remains dynamic. You know, in a sense, we human beings, with our personality, are precipitations of the thought form of a monad, really, aided by its extension, the soul. We are a great, we are an attenuation of monadic intent. So it's a coming together of various energies, and the form that they take is important, and the form is supposed to represent the idea in the mind of the monad, or in the mind of the thinker, the creative thinker, and is held in that arrangement as long as the will of the creative thinker decides to hold it. So let's, I think the thing to do here is to call that to our attention by enlarging. An aggregation of energies arranged in a certain form in order to express the idea of some creative thinker. It's not just a thrown together aggregation, thoughtlessly thrown together. I suppose one can precipitate various chaotic energies and it will still be in some sense a precipitation, but we're looking at this in a fairly particular sense, and in relation to the white magical process. So, It expresses the idea of some creative thinker, and it is qualified or characterized by the nature of his thought, which a chaotic precipitation would not be, and held in that peculiar form, as long as his thought remains dynamic, as long as it is fed by the will, as long as he willfully intends to hold it, of course, this within reason. When the soul decides that form has served its purpose, it looks away and no longer sustains that thought form we call the human body and other parts of the personality, and that body begins to fall apart and can no longer by itself sustain the form in which it was precipitated. These words are an attempt to express a symbol found in the same ancient book, or rather a compilation referred to earlier in our consideration of Rule 13. We realize that Master DK, having much of the planet Mercury in his makeup, has a job of translating, transforming, interpreting symbols to which we have no access, sources to which we have no access, and if we did, could we read them even? But he is able to, and conveys to our types of mind some approximation of the original. Certainly these symbols emerging from the remote past constitute the working tools, if I might so express it, of the thinkers who guide our racial and planetary evolution. And that's not the one, is it? Okay, so let's make sure that we have the correct bracket, you know. I think that'll do. Okay, and then we, right. And these are members of the spiritual hierarchy of the planet, the guides. So the plan itself, the divine plan, is written out on some material, a peculiar alloy or metal, on a number of pages of such a material, and it consists of, well, really, columns of symbols, which, to those who can read, inform the reader of the direction and activities which are meant to precipitate the plan. All right, so there are always guides to our planetary evolution, and that we must always remember, and our goal is to contact these guides and be even more in touch with what their intent may be, because they have certainly a much better idea of what is the nature of the divine plan. This particular symbol might be described as follows. Well, it'll give us an idea, right? A blazing sun forms the background, and at the very center of that sun appears an eye, projecting downwards towards the right. An eye projecting downwards towards the right. From this eye pours a stream of energy in the form of a beam of light. It rays outward, widening towards the end into a second circle, and in that circle is a cross resembling what is called a Maltese cross. At the center of the cross is another eye, and within the eye, the sacred word om, presumably, between the arms of the cross, forming, therefore, another cross is the swastika, you know, as a symbol of creation and manifestation, and not as a perverted symbol used by ignorant racists. Another cross is the swastika, the arms emerging from behind the Maltese cross. At the bottom of the page, whereon this symbol is found, are four geometrical forms, and some of these are referred to by HBB and were taken by her from this ancient picture. They are all well known but seldom applied by esotericists to the creative work they are. The cube, the five-pointed star, the six-pointed star, and the eight-sided diamond, I suppose, an octahedron, superimposed upon each other. They constitute, therefore, the base of the symbol. HBB refers also to the point, the line, and the circle, but these, with the triangle, have been exoterically applied to deity and the manifested universe. Later, these other forms will also be applied to God and to man in the exoteric sense, but this will only be when the truths of the ageless wisdom are universally recognized. Well, would you like to interpret that? I don't think that we should spend a great deal of time attempting to do so. DK has given us what we must understand. So this is the symbol that we are dealing with, and it carries the thought and the quality of some particular thinker. These words are an attempt to express a symbol found in some ancient book. And certainly these symbols emerging from the remote past constitute the tools, the working tools of the guides. What appears to be the case here is that this symbol tells us the nature of a precipitation. The central sun, from which the beams are directed, or the beam in this case, contains the entire thought and can be looked at as the creative thinker. Now, the stream goes towards the right. I'm not sure whether that's the right of the viewer, or more probably the right of the creative thinker. And it seeks form. And the form is suggested by the Maltese cross and by the swastika in back of it, which means that there will be a precipitation, because the swastika, well, you can look at it in two ways. One takes us out of matter, and the other, more popular presentation, takes the thought and externalizes it, materializes it. The symbols at the bottom, you know, the cube of space, we might call it the six subplanes of the logoic plane, and we might look at man as that particular cube from the monad on down, with the very essence of the monad found in a liberated state within the sea of fire, which is the logoic plane. The five-pointed star namely the five planes of Atma and or the soul, the six-pointed star, the monad in its highest understanding, and the eight-sided diamond, all of these being superimposed upon each other in a manner about which I'm not sure, but maybe if we consulted this book called The Mathematics of Cosmic Mind by Plummer, we would see such a superimposition. I suppose we're dealing with an octahedron here, and I suppose there is a square somehow in the midst of this octahedron, this eight-sided diamond. Now you kind of wonder, is this diamond suggesting the jewel in the lotus? Generally speaking, they are considered to be seven rays coming forth, but sometimes reaching from the jewel in the lotus via eight streams of energy is suggested. The number eight, of course, corresponds with Mercury and with communication and with a reaching, arraying forth, and eight is closely connected as well with the star Sirius. And it is the number, from one point of view, from a higher point of view, of the Christ. Okay, it has also some lower meanings. I guess without the symbol in front of us, it's hard really to decipher, but I think somewhere, maybe in the secret doctrine, that figure can be seen. We oftentimes see the five-pointed star and the six-pointed star together. Generally, the six-pointed star is elevated and has a higher meaning than the five-pointed star. Okay. Let us say that in any case, these four symbols are all of them having a strong reference to the important aspects of the microcosm, or maybe any created extension of a higher creator. So we find the monad here, we find the soul here, maybe we find the jewel in the lotus, possibly, and the personality is included. There's something about the cube related to Mars and which represents materiality. But let's just say this whole symbol is about precipitation and what precipitation is. Since the beam is going off to the right, it's a positive beam, you know, because the magician or any great creator has to set his form upon the proper path, and that would be toward the right. As for the exact meaning in this context of the Maltese cross, I cannot be sure, but again, we have the eight from the four arms of the Maltese cross and the four arms of the swastika, which may be turning in the direction of precipitation, we are not told. But the higher aspects that the Creator is thinking are brought into form via this kind of symbol, and it will affect maybe any of the created forms, that of a man, that of a higher kingdom of nature, that of a globe, you know, the cube, the five-pointed star, the six-pointed star, the eight-sided diamond, all of these can represent the major aspects or factors in any one of a variety of projected forms for beings of different capability. Man is probably, you know, one of the lowest, and there are higher beings for whom, to whom these would apply. All right, so basically he's saying we have to learn how to read the symbols, and here is a symbol which itself deals with what the nature of a precipitation actually is, and it has in this context a very positive meaning. You know, it's coming from a sun, it's coming from a kind of a deity, it's taking the right-hand path, it has the number of the Christ involved in it, it references the star Sirius, it is an extension from using an intermediary, and Mercury associated with the number 8 is always an intermediary, and the general characteristics of any entity are somehow indicated by these four superimposed symbols at the bottom of the chart. Well, you know, it's not really an exhaustive interpretation, but just what I've said is just an indication of how one might be able to think of such a symbol, and maybe, of course, you may have your own methods of doing so. Okay, I'm going to always make sure that I have this. Okay. The laws of thought are the laws of creation, and the entire creative work is carried forward on the etheric level. What etheric level do we mean? Well, there's the systemic etheric level, and there is the cosmic etheric level. So do we, let's see if I can get it here, do we mean the systemic ethers or the cosmic ethers or both? It seems like when we're dealing with a high creator, the cosmic ethers are necessarily involved as the origin of the idea to be manifested. And when we're dealing with the cosmic ethers, we are already entering the realm of ideas and not simply those denser factors which we call thought. Although from another perspective, the higher types of intuitions and ideas will be residing in the realm of the super cosmic ethers, namely these. If I can go there, the super cosmic ethers will be the cosmic Buddha, cosmic atmic, cosmic monadic, and cosmic logoic or adic planes. And then the realm of thought will even begin on the cosmic mental from a cosmic perspective and descend accordingly. So what we call an intuition, or an idea, or what we call a thought depends upon the scope of the context with which we are dealing. If we're dealing with the systemic context and the life of man, it's all pretty well confined to the cosmic physical plane, and we call those formulations energy packets on the cosmic ethers. We call them ideas. But from another perspective, a cosmic perspective, they are simply precipitations. They are thoughts which are descending and not ideas at all, looked at from the cosmic angle. Okay, so let's see, where are we here? The laws of thought are the laws of creation, and the entire creative work is carried forward on the etheric level. I mean, all the formulations of our physical nature have to do with systemic creative activity on the systemic ethers. And this constitutes, he says, practically a second formula. The creator of the solar system confines his attention to the work performed on what we call the four higher planes of our system. Okay, now he's getting into what I suggested a little bit here. And this is, the cosmic ethers. Okay, let's see if I have anything here about cosmic ethers rather than having to write it out. No, I don't. So I will write it out. And CSET, cosmic etheric matter, I have that. ET. So this is going to be a cosmic ether. And that's good. And then I'm going to have something a little extensive. Cosmic ethers. CS. ETS. Cosmic ethers. Okay. Thanks for your patience. I'm just trying to hit my stride here a little bit. So a second formula. The creator of a solar system confines his attention to the work performed on what we call the four higher planes of our system, the cosmic ethers. The lower three are mental, emotional, etheric, physical planes, constituting the cosmic dense, physical. I suppose this means plane, I guess. The cosmic dense physical plane. And we're familiar with that idea. Maybe the lower 18 subplanes are more dense by themselves than if we would include the three planes of higher mind. They are in a category somewhat on their own. They are part of the dense physical body of the solar logos, but when it comes to the planetary logos, do we have there for the planetary logos the beginning of the etheric planes? Or do the three higher mental subplanes also constitute part of the dense physical body of the planetary logos? I think, you know, there's some investigating to do on that question. So the lower three constituting the cosmic dense physical plane are in the nature of precipitation. Okay. And they are not principled from the cosmic perspective, but certainly they are principled from the perspective of man. Only the very lowest dense physical subplane is not, or the three lower subplanes, including liquid and gaseous, are not principled from the perspective of man. The lower three constituting the cosmic dense physical plane are in the nature of precipitation. They are objective, because the matter of space responds to or is attracted by the potency of the four higher etheric vibrations. And by this, I think we mean, try to get this correct, PRBL, probably the systemic ethers. These, in their turn, are motivated or swept into activity by the divine impact of the divine thought. Okay, and that divine thought we can assume, as far as the cosmic physical plane is concerned, occurring on the cosmic ethers, which for us is really the beginning of the spiritual realm. When we're in the dense physical body of the, let's say, the solar logos, we're not really yet in the spiritual realm. We might look at the higher mental plane as kind of transitional towards the spiritual realm, because it has the projection of the solar angel as within the egoic lotus, growing, manifesting within itself. The higher, the planes of higher mind have the egoic lotus growing there, supported by an emanation or a energy stream from the solar angel. So these lower three are objective, because the matter of space responds to or is attracted by the potency of the four higher etheric vibrations, and they are swept into kind of an aggregation or congestion. We are sometimes told that dense physical forms are really congestions in space. So aggregations and congestions. These, in their turn, are motivated or swept into activity by the divine impact of the divine thought, which, you know, we can say is occurring within the cosmic ethers, though its origin is much higher on the cosmic mental plane. And just as our Buddhic plane is considered to be the home of transcendental mind, so the cosmic Buddhic plane would have its higher analogy, and on this cosmic Buddhic plane would have something that goes beyond divine thought per se. It would be divine intuition, cosmic intuition. Well, those are just words to fill out the picture. And, you know, we have a lot of attainment to achieve before we can come close to understanding what those structures and those vibratory levels might be. If, in fact, those higher cosmic planes have their own kind of matter. We know the cosmic physical plane does have its own kind of matter, built on what we call the bubble or bubbles in the koilon. But is it also true of the higher cosmic planes? What is the material structure, if there is one, of those planes? It's beyond us. And as the Tibetan says, he hasn't been there, so he can hint, he can infer, and he is a master of the law of analogy, and in the books, much is said in these sort of shambolic libraries, let's say. But to speculate upon the prakritic or non-prakritic condition of the cosmic plane superior to the cosmic physical plane, well, you know, it would be at this point maybe an exercise in futility, although maybe the analogy does hold. Okay, so we've looked at this in the cosmic sense. Now, maybe there is a similar procedure where man is concerned. You know, the law of analogy and the titer law of correspondences, these are the great interpretive laws of various structures found in universe, in galaxy, in solar system, on planet, and also within man. And of course, I'm leaving out quite a number of levels necessarily. Just as soon as man becomes a thinker, and can formulate his thought, desire its manifestation, and can energize by recognition. And interesting how energizing of the four ethers occurs. Energized by recognition of the four ethers, a dense physical manifestation is inevitable. So that's an important statement, isn't it? Talking about the creative process. Okay, so let me call attention to that. Excuse me. Through enlargement. Okay, just as soon as man becomes a thinker and can formulate his thought, desire its manifestation, and can energize by recognition the four ethers, I think we need some instruction in how that can be carried out. A dense physical manifestation is inevitable. All the work has been done in the principled realms, and the rest is a dense precipitation, which is created by the moving forward of all that has been assembled on the principled planes. He will attract by his pranic energy, colored by desire, high or low, and animated by the potency of his thought, just as much of the responsive matter in space as is needed to give body to his form. I guess, you know, at this point, the man is a magician. I'm not sure how in our creative enterprises, which are still so material, how we do this. But let's just say it seems to be an automatic process in this context. So we have the waiting form. It is mentally coherent. It is filled with the desire for appearance. And it has the formulating etheric energy, holding it together so that it can present a physical form, which can then be clothed in the very densest type of matter of which presently we can be aware. Maybe there, you know, is some kind of matter of an eighth sphere or below the type of dense matter that we consider the lowest. But, you know, that's a speculation. It's probably correct, but we have no way to deal with that, and probably it's off limits for us anyway. There are certain areas, you know, that are off limits. Maybe, I think, the seventh subplane of the astral plane, where he tells us the usual, the hell state of the average believer is found, is off limits, and also the sixth subplane, we are not supposed to have matter of those two subplanes at all built into our astral body. But sometimes I wonder, you know, these people who are creating horror films and have an imagination which seems to range in this ghastly and ghoulish area, whether they have breached some sort of barrier which puts them at the mercy of those forces, and all they can do then is to express dramatically what they find, either that or be obsessed or haunted or in some way driven into a very unhealthy state with regard to their psyche. So we stay away from those monstrous areas where everything is cacophony and division and dissonance. We stay away from those. We may occasionally get an intrusion, but what I understand from Master Moria is that if the heart center is strong enough, those obsessing intrusions will not occur. Okay. Much of this is dealt with in a treatise on cosmic fire, and as these instructions are intended to deal with the inner development of the aspirant, I shall not carry these ideas further beyond prophesying. Okay, well, this would take us into the 1980s, that within 50 years, the true significance of precipitations will be engrossing the attention of the scientists. In a way, this is true. How would we say? Well, if you look at the particle physics, and such an elaborate technical setup as they have with the CERN tunnels, you know, where huge speeds of particles can be achieved and collisions arranged and so forth, they are watching what are the results of these collisions, and for maybe a few nanoseconds, extremely short periods of time, precipitations seem to occur, which vanish almost immediately. But maybe these are precipitations of etheric states, and maybe in this kind of research, the ether, which had been banished from serious consideration for a long time, ever since the Michelson-Morley experiments, I think in the 1880s, something like that, the ether will be redefined or reclaimed, at least a state, an energy state from which precipitations come forth and then rapidly disappear will be hypothesized. And maybe so in this way, DK's prophecy here is rendered true. Not everything, I think, that he said would occur has occurred within the timing he suggested, but the factor of being on time or promoting delay is very much up to man. So these developments will have to occur, and how delayed they will be will depend much on human response. Excuse me. Occult students would do well to give the subject careful thought. It can be approached in two ways. I think especially those, you know, who are using the fifth rate sensibly. On the other hand, he did say that the scientists who are using the fifth ray and who are working under the fifth ray are in many ways the true occultists. So the door to the scientific approach to that which appears to be insubstantial and immaterial is greatly aided by the fifth ray, and we all have to really learn how to use it. Okay, we should give all this careful thought. It can be approached in two ways. There is, first of all, the study of the objective world in which the individual finds himself. Now, we can't evade this. This is called the study of the Garden of Gethsemane, garment of God. Okay, and there's a wonderful section from the old commentary where the avid fifth-rate type is giving all his attention to studying the garment and forgetting who it is and what it is that lies behind and within the garment, and which demands discovery, which is difficult at first for the fifth ray type, so concerned is he about the particular aspects of the externalization of that inner God, so concerned is he about the garment being worn by the inner God. And it's a beautiful section. I wonder if I can just do a little bit here to suggest where it might be found without reading the whole thing. And he's going to say something like this: know me. And so here it is in the Law of Repulse. The word goes forth from soul to form. I'm just reading randomly here. Behind that form I am, know me. Cherish and know and understand the nature of the veils of life, but know as well the one who lives, know me. Let not the forms of nature, their processes and powers, prevent thy searching for the mystery which brought the mysteries to thee, lower cap, see, full cap and then lowercase. Know well the form, but leave it joyously and search for me. Well, this is a marvelous statement about how the fifth ray type has to repel his usual prejudices. So somehow here found on page 368 and 369 is a great deal of what we need to know about the garment of God and the mystery behind that garment. In other words, we can involve ourselves with many mysteries, but the mystery of it all tends to escape us if we are too hard-headed or too skeptical, or believe only in the reality of precipitations which we can sense and which we can register. Okay, so that is his prophecy, and maybe in the precipitations of the particles in the particle physics, we are finding something that is fulfilling DK's prophecy here. So, first of all, we study, he says, the objective world, the garment of God, in which the individual finds himself. Okay. GROG. Garment of God. I tend to want to, that's like grog, you know. You want that GROG. Grog makes one groggy, you know. Garment of God. And GOG will be Garden of Gethsemane. He will need to consider the fact that his body of manifestation is a precipitation, that it is a result of his potent thought, as a soul, I guess, potent thought and desire, and of his recognition of the four ethers. So somehow we are involved in creating this body, at least later we are. I think, wait a second, have I made everything disappear? No, not quite. Good thing too, if you try to ever do this in a word processing program such as Gmail, you can work for a long time and things will disappear if you hit the wrong button. And unless you know how to reclaim them, and I'm not so good at that, well, it's a very disappointing process. So he will have to consider that his body of manifestation is a precipitation, and of course also any form that he creates for a soul idea that he contacts and for which he is responsible if he cooperates or as he cooperates with the divine plan. And that is the result of his potent thought and desire and of his recognition of the four ethers. And, you know, let's just say, no, that's Grog. No. As a magician, you know, functioning. And working as a magician. Well, the soul is the great magician, of course. But as we mature in our consciousness, I think that within this higher mental plane, we can begin to cooperate with the angel of the presence, or whatever we will call that extension of the solar angel, which is present and supports the vitality and form and structure of the egoic lotus. He will need to understand that this form, which he has created, will persist just as long as the dynamic power of his thought holds it together, and that it will dissipate when he, occultly speaking, takes his eye away. Well, in a way, the solar angel or angel of the presence has only to look away from the lower man, and the death process will begin. He will need to consider also that his environment is the result of the work of an aggregate of group thinkers. Thinkers. And it says your group to which he belongs. It seems like something is missing. An aggregate of group thinkers, maybe, to which he belongs. This concept can be traced back all the way from a family group to a group of egos who are closely interlinked, form a group, an egoic group, on the higher level of the mental plane, and on, again, to the seven major thinkers of the universe. And what do we mean by a universe? There are greater and lesser meanings. Here, it seems that he does not mean the grand entirety, the everything found in the universal logos and its extension. But maybe a solar logos, maybe a solar system can be considered, in a sense, as a universe. So thinkers have somehow created the environment. I guess that's really true. I mean, when we say, you know, what thinker is behind a tree, a rock, a lake, whatever. There are great thinkers for whom these appearances are precipitations. And for man, man as man did not create them, but they constitute his environment. So I had a friend, you know, who always said, well, keep your eye on your creation, because if you take it away and start thinking a great deal about other things and ignore the creation, it will fall apart. And sure enough, she was correct about that. Okay, so, you know, maybe we have universal lords of the seven rays on a universal level, but we certainly have the seven spirits before the solar systemic throne. And how would I, seven spirits before the throne? Right, we have that. These seven, in their turn, are swept into activity by the three supreme magical workers the manifested Trinity. Now, I think I can show you that in this diagram. It's the three above the seven. The seven spirits before the throne are these seven triangles, at least in their etheric presentation, and the three above are the three logoi. But of course, we probably can trace the essence of these beings to much higher cosmic planes. So all of these great beings appearing on the cosmic physical, it's not that they don't have the cosmic monadic level operating at their very center. So these seven in their turn are swept into activity by the three supreme magical workers, the manifested Trinity, the three Logoi, the Father, Son, and Holy Ghost. These three in due course will be recognized as responsive to the thought of the one Creator, the unmanifested Logos. Well, he could be speaking in both, in both universal and solar systemic terms. He could be speaking of any of the great entities here. The unmanifested Logos, well, through his emanative extensions, he is manifested. So, through his emanative extensions, he is manifested. But in his highest position in a universe or in a solar system, there are others who represent him, we might say. There's a lot of depth to this when we get into the subject of the creators and the manner in which they undertake a self-becoming, which we call creation often, but which is more, I think, an emanative self-becoming. And I want to say here that the great creators undertake an emanative self-becoming. The word recognition is one of the most important in the language of occultism. Maybe we recognize, you know, we've descended along a certain line of emanative contraction, we might say, and we reascend, and as we reascend, we recognize what we saw when we were descending. So the word recognition is one of the most important in the language of occultism and holds the clue to the mystery of being. It is related to karmic activity, and on it the lords of time and space depend. I don't know how much we can make of that just yet. Certainly these great lords have karmic administration to deal with, and they have to recognize where it is appropriate. It is hard to illustrate this in simple terms, but it might be said that the problem of God himself consists in this, and that he must manifest a threefold recognition. But I think what we can do now is to say that this is the end of hour one for program? Number five. Somewhere we have this program number five for a treatise on white magic video commentary, namely rules for the physical plane. Oop, where are we? he must manifest, right? PHP rules for the physical plane. And so we're involved in rule 13.2. All right, I think we can simply move forward. Sorry for this ongoing cough. Okay, so anyway, here it is, the problem of God. Who is God? Well, maybe God is the Solar Logos, the hierarch of any particular great system. In another respect, God is our planetary logos, and it was that the Christ was speaking more to Sanat Kumara as an extension of the planetary logos than he was speaking to what we might call the God of the solar system, or the God of the local cosmic logos, or the God of the universe. Maybe essentially they're all the same, but we have to have our proper limits. And when Christ was addressing the Father, who was he addressing? And I believe that in this case it was going to be Sanat Kumara as a representative of the entirety of the planetary logos, but on our particular globe and on the higher levels of our globe. So what are the recognitions? A threefold recognition. What is this problem of God that he must manifest? A threefold recognition. Well, there must be recognition of the past. I guess before any kind of karma can be dealt with, some of these recognitions have to come into play. The solar angel itself must play the role of God and recognize some of these things with respect to the personality or the being, that monadic extension which the solar angel is supervising. So recognition of the past, which necessarily involves a recognition of that matter in space, which is, through past association, already colored by thought and purpose, and maybe the thought and purpose of the personality under supervision, when the one who is recognizing is of a lesser degree than God itself. But anyway, what type of matter has been affected, qualified, colored by thought and purpose? And what has been the result of that past experience in terms of the coloring and the kind of impression made? Recognition of the four grades of lives, which, again, through past association, are capable of response to his new thought for the present and can therefore carry out his plans and work in collaboration with him. They subject their individual purposes to the one divine plan. And maybe, what we're dealing with here are creative hierarchies. Okay. Excuse me. Okay, so now I have it. It sounds like we're dealing with self-conscious beings. So the types of lives may be measured from man and above. If we are to look at, from the ordinary list, there we go. Okay, so here are various creative hierarchies or aggregations of monads, and here's the human hierarchy, but above them and ruling or at least found expressing upon the cosmic ethers are the lesser builders, the divine builders, and the divine flame. I don't think that we can talk about cooperation coming in any conscious sense from the three hierarchies below humanity, the crocodiles or the lunar lords or the elemental lives, baskets of nourishment, etc. So we have to speculate here that that is what he is meaning. So God has to recognize the four grades of lives, conditioning the four cosmic ethers who can collaborate with him. And, you know, in these places are found the Raja Deva lords and great beings altogether, solar angels, and even higher beings when compared to man. So they subject their individual purposes to the one divine plan, and no unconscious or non-individualized creative hierarchy could possibly do that. Recognition of the objective which exists in his... something has happened here, and I'm sorry. So let me search for it. And we'll say that it's in, okay, recognition of the objective, called of the objective which exists, and what are we going to have? Exists in his mind. Okay, that's what we have. And the sea doesn't belong there. Somehow I wonder what has happened to corrupt some of these sentences. So recognition of the objective which exists in his mind. It is the mind of God which is responsible for the great variety of emanations and their interplay, all to fulfill eventually his divine archetypal purpose for that particular creation, whether it's a planet or a solar system or even a universe. This, in its turn, necessitates a one-pointed focusing upon the goal and the holding of the purpose intact throughout the vicissitudes of the creative work. So this is a hint for us, even though we're talking about, you know, a great deity here, this is a hint for us. And in spite of the potency of the many divine thinkers who have been attracted to him by a similarity of ideas. So we have to hold our creative intent. God must hold its creative intent, as must we when we are magical creators. Okay. So these are the three recognitions, that word being so important in occultism. And whatever the God may be, and there are many gods, and St. Paul has said of us, know ye not that ye are gods? We are, in a certain way, any extension of a monad is a god. There's only one monad, it's one god, and all of its emanations are gods which are circumscribed by tightening or lessening environments. So, the past, recognition of the past, and that which has occurred as a result of the past, the coloration, recognition of the four grades of lives, which can cooperate in the, I suppose, precipitation, and recognition of the objective, which exists in his own mind. I wonder if the universal logos does not have that particular issue. Because, in a way, the universal logos is sent forth from a condition of pre-universal absolute infinitude. And does this extension of the absolute deity, which the universal logos is, does it know entirely what is the content of that which it must manifest through a self-becoming that we call a universe? Anyway, there's so much more, you know, take man, for instance, there's so much more in us right now about our destiny than our particular, our conscious mind at present registers or recognizes. We have to rediscover all that is latent within us in terms of our role at various stages of vibratory elevation, our role in the divine plan for the planet, the solar system, the cosmic logos, the supercosmic logos, the galaxy, and on and on and on. We have a role to play, and of course our identity will change as we go. We'll find ourselves to be, in essence, really wider and wider beings than the little individual we thought ourselves to be. So some kind of merging of identities will occur as we ascend until finally there's only one identity remaining, and that is the universal logos itself. So God must, whatever the God is, the problem of God is to these three recognitions. Now, who would have thought of that, you know, independently of Master DK or a messenger, an equivalent messenger from the hierarchy? We just are being presented with thoughts which are for us without hierarchical tutelage, thoughts which are beyond the pale, but now which have swept into our range of consciousness, at least to be recognized, if not at first much understood. Okay, well, here's a nice word, hopeless. And I was feeling maybe a little bit that way when I looked at all this. It is hopeless to attempt to avoid the use of personal pronouns when talking pictorially and symbolically. I've seen people sort of twist themselves into a pretzel trying to avoid using the word I, thereby emphasizing the meaning of the I far more than they would if they just simply used the word I and be done with it. It doesn't mean the same thing for everybody, for sure. And there's a sense in which the word I is even greater than the word we, because it represents the one and not the unified multiplicity. Anyway, he's talking about language. If the student will bear in mind that such an attempt to reduce cosmic principles and concept to words is in itself ridiculous, and that the only possible thing to do is to present a picture, then no harm can eventuate. Well, there's DK using the word ridiculous. And that's astonishing. It's not a word he would normally use, but I'm going to emphasize it because it tells us so much about his lack of faith in words. Okay. To convey his meaning, you know, he has some degree of frustration when he attempts to convey his meaning. But no harm will eventuate if we just realize that we're creating kind of a picture and we do not hope for true accuracy in the presentation because the human faculties are so undeveloped for such a purpose. Okay. All right. But the pictures change as evolution proceeds upon its way, and the picture of today will, at a later date, be deemed no better than a child's rough scrawl. You know how when we have children that come home from school and say, hey, look what I drew, and, you know, it's the square, and it's the triangle, and it's a house, and little figures are there, and we compliment that effort, of course, but we know what is a child's rough scrawl compared to a detailed blueprint, a detailed drawing which accounts for all of the constituents and their scope and their relationships. We know these things. So one day our picture of our planet and solar system and ever-enlarging context will be just seen to be rough indeed. And if we're humble, well, you know, we'll just accept that that is inevitable, given the undevelopment, temporary undevelopment of our mind. A new picture will then be presented, simpler and more harmonious and more beautiful, until it, in its turn, is deemed inadequate. And you wonder about the picture of the final consummation of a universe as the universal logos sees it. And you kind of think of comparing that to the absoluteness of infinitude. And again, you know, it's not adequate in terms of what reality, post-pralayic and pre-universal reality, really is. The same recognitions on a lesser scale govern the activities of the solar angel. Now, we're coming down a bit, right? Are we not? So let's just put it here. It always happens to me. We are descending and dealing with a great, though lesser, creator than, quote, God, whatever God may be. We have to have a certain tolerance for this word God, because after all, it is a relative term, very relative. When you think of it, our planetary logos is certainly a god, and so is the solar logos, and so are the myriad, well, so many, of the greater entities of far greater scope than a solar logos. They are all gods, all the way up to and including the god of our universe, who is always, in a way, the same, an extension of the greatest God, which is the absolute deity. And that absolute deity is post-pralayic and pre-universal, and it has the power to act. Whereas the absoluteness, which is indescribable, you know, what can you say, does not have the power to act. At least creatively, it can represent itself somehow as the absolute deity who is the actor. At least, you know, for the present and according to my present level of ignorance, this is my conception of these things. But, of course, you know, I'm aware of the child's rough scrawl. But we have to ascend in our picturing of the universe through a variety of scrawls that get a little clearer and a little more beautiful, a little more harmonious as we go. So anyway, the same types of recognitions here, on a lesser scale, govern the activities of the solar angel as he proceeds with the work of incarnation and of manifestation upon the physical plane. I guess, what does he have to know? You know, the past, he's got to recognize the grades of lives with which he can work, and maybe they have more to do with the lives of the four ethers, perhaps, or maybe with the four aspects of the personality. And he has to, from having assessed the progress of the extension of the human monad, which he is supervising, he has to know the objective, which is in the mind of that monad, and his own plan for helping that human monad achieve its goal. He becomes an intermediary and makes it possible for the human monad, through its extension, the ego on the higher mental plane, and then the personality, to achieve its goal. So really, the solar angel is a great bridge, and somehow a real Christ-like figure, a real helper, bringing that kind of goal of the monad into possibility, as there have been some significant breaks in the alignment along the way, and the solar angel is needed to fill in those breaks. Okay, so the solar angel, he has in his turn, let's see what his recognitions have to be, and whether when I said those things I was anywhere near what the Tibetan is going to say here. He has in his turn to recognize the matter of the three planes of human expression, which are already through past association colored by his vibration. The vibration of the being he, the solar angel, is assisting. And maybe, you know, maybe the solar angelic vibration itself, since the solar angel is engaged with the man who is the extension of the monad, maybe this matter can be reclaimed, and certain of the lunar lords who have done their work in relation to the personality are brought back into the picture. He has to recognize the groups of lives with which he has had relation and with which he must again work. These are, I think, lunar lords, and they constitute the very substance of the personality, and they are already impressed by the entity in whom they form lower but constituent parts. Finally, he has, throughout the tiny cycle of an incarnation, and, well, you know, a life can look long, but in terms of the wider time scale, it's just like a, what do they call them, a May fly or a June fly, you know, they live for a day. So our idea of length of life will have to be adjusted as we begin to adopt the perspective of the soul. Finally, he has, throughout the tiny cycle of an incarnation, to hold his purpose steady. He's like a god, right? And to see that each life carries that purpose forward into fuller manifestation and completion. Let's just say here that from the perspective of the solar angel, there is knowledge of what the man, as an extension, as a monad in extension, needs to accomplish. And maybe the solar angel, also not being quite an avatar yet, we're told, has to accomplish something on its own, and will be growing because of that accomplishment. I mean, an avatar is not so much growing or need not fulfill the things that it does on behalf of the lives which it is aiding, but other higher lives are still growing in the process of aiding lesser lives. So an avatar seems to descend in a purely altruistic manner, and the state of the solar angel is one of great altruism, but there is also benefit to itself. After all, it was just recently a man, a human being in a previous solar system, so maybe has not reached that state of utter altruism by which an avatar descends without any benefit to itself whatsoever. But then this word avatar is, of course, used in various ways. Lincoln was an avatar for the human race, and we can be sure that some type of benefit to his soul came to him from being able to, under the law of synthesis, somehow hold the union of the North and South together, and we might almost call it the union of the soul and the personality. Even today, the United States under Gemini is very divided between second-ray soul impulses and sixth-ray personality impulses, and that same rending process is occurring, which seems to want to tear the two apart. So Lincoln did so well in fulfilling the intended synthesis, what's been called the preservation of the Union. And, you know, I know it's political now, and those of you who read or hear this may be hearing it years after, but I do wish at this time when the United States is being so rent by the different directions of soul and personality that a great individual like Lincoln could appear once again, functioning under the law of synthesis and not under the great heresy of separateness. Some divide in almost everything they do and work against the unity and the synthesis which must prevail, and others have in them such a heart, such a mind, such a capacious enfoldment of their nation that they work for the synthesis of that nation and all the factors within it. Now we're descending, you know, from God to the solar angel to the human being. The work of the human being also, as he endeavors to become a creative thinker, lies along analogous lines. His creative work will be, we're dealing with creative thinkers in all of this. In all of this, we are dealing with the recognitions of creative thinkers, the necessary recognitions of creative thinkers, whether it's a God or what we refer to as God, whether it's a solar angel, a great being who relatively recently was once a human being, or whether we're dealing with the human being per se. All right, so his creative work will be successful if he can recognize the tendency of his mind, and that tendency emerges through the medium of his present interests, for these have their roots in the past. So this is the recognition for man, for the human being. This represents the recognition of the past. It will be successful if he can recognize the vibration of the group of lives in line with whose thought his creative work must proceed. For unlike the deity in the solar system, that's who that deity is. Okay, now we see. That deity is, in this context, in this case, a solar logos. But let me, in this context, we'll do it that way, in this context, for the future. Okay. So, if he can recognize the vibration of the group of lives in line with whose thought his creative work must proceed, for unlike the deity in the solar system, he cannot work soul and alone. He must work in group formation. He must, the human being must work in group formation. So maybe we have, masters here and higher masters and Chohans and shambolic beings as well as group associates. Anyway, he has to work together with others. He cannot direct full aspects of the divine plan. He cannot work soul. Now, look at that word. You see what he's done? Soul and alone, because that's the name of our solar logos in a way. Soul, S-O-L. And it represents the word solitude. And a great feature of our solar logos, or maybe any solar logos, is that it can work on its own in the all-oneness that he realizes with respect to his coming solar system. And who shall say whether in those greater spheres of existence in which our deity plays his part, let's just say he's getting to that point, a cosmic logos, for instance, or a supercosmic logos, he is any more free from cosmic group influences than the individual human individual is free from impression by his environing impulses. This is where Master DK lets his speculative mind range. So, there are, man works in connection with groups and groups surrounding him, and also under the direction of groups like an ashram or a greater ashram or a group like Shambhala. Let's just say, recognition of creative thinkers. Okay, for a human being, this represents a recognition of the past. He cannot work soul and alone. There are groups in the ashram and the greater ashram and Shambhala with which the human being must perforce work, and also on his own level of soul groups, egoic groups, and so forth. So the group awareness is very important for how the human being must work, but then DK says, well, maybe it's also so for the great cosmic logoi and supercosmic logoi and who knows, galactic logoi, that they too have group influences. So maybe these great beings also are working in cooperation with higher group influences the law of analogy may hold. Okay, he has to recognize, this is man, I guess, the purpose for which he has deemed it wise to build a thought form, if he is a creative worker, man, the creative thinker, working magically, and he must hold that purpose steady and unimpaired throughout the whole period of objectivity, and not stop sounding its note or envisioning its structure. Okay, what do we have here? Envisioning. Okay, that'll do. This we call one-pointed attention. I mean, every great being is somehow a disciple to someone or something. And one-pointedness is the characteristic of the disciple. This we call one-pointed attention. And this creative work is one of the as yet unrecognized goals of the meditation process. So often we say, well, I will relieve my stress through meditation. I will become a more relaxed being. I will be happier. Maybe I'll be more in tune with things and more successful in my life. But basically, he's saying a meditative work, the meditative process, is leading to greater and greater ability to perform creative work. Hitherto, the emphasis has been laid on the achieving of a focused attention and on the necessity, I guess, what do we call that? You know, first phase of meditation, concentration, and on the necessity, when that has been attained, of coming in touch with the soul, the spiritual thinker, and we might say, maybe this is the Virgo phase. You know how each one of these phases of meditation is assigned a sign of the zodiac. You know how it goes: Leo concentration, Virgo meditation, Libra contemplation, Scorpio illumination, Sagittarius inspiration, and Capricorn finally initiation. At least in that sequence, I've extended it a little bit, not all of them in terms of eyes, but Pisces, at least is identification, even though I call Aquarius universalization. Couldn't find an I word. Maybe someone else can. So maybe this is the Virgo phase of getting in touch with the soul, because there is some kind of deep process, internal process, which few may see, which allow the Virgo type to access the soul, it being such a secondary sign in a way. Virgo is presently more so than any other. But later decades will see the emerging of a technique of creation. So that's what we're learning, how to be creative workers. And we're learning how to, I say, self-become. It's my impression. When soul, mind, and brain, he keeps on repeating that triplicity, usually leaving out the disruptive astral body, oftentimes out of alignment, but even it has to be sort of negated and tranquilized and passed through. When soul, mind, and brain are unified, and facility in unification has been achieved, further instruction will be given in the creative arts. Now, maybe he's talking about the coming Renaissance, probably to be produced through meditation on the fourth ray. But he's also saying that the technique of creation and of meditation, which leads to right performance of the technique of creation, is a creative art. Meditation, yeah, okay. So basically he's saying meditation and creative work are part of a great creative art. I mean, so much is coming in the new age. We have the stress now that we have to live through. Wait a second, something just happened to my chronometer. Yes, it is still going, but it likes to hide, you know. And I like to be reasonably accurate in the timing of these programs, though sometimes I am wildly off the mark. It's a big study when you undertake to look deeply into Master DK's books. You know, it's not for everybody. Not everybody will have the patience, will have the attitude of pondering, will be willing to stop and really dwell with until greater meaning appears. When soul, mind, and brain are unified and the facility in unification has been achieved, achieving, you know, these unification of these three, and we can assess ourselves to see where we are in this unification of soul, mind, and brain, then further instruction will be given in the creative art. The masters are always assessing the degree of assimilation that the individual and humanity as a whole, in different groups, let's say within humanity, have thus far achieved. Meditation is the first basic lesson given when men have achieved the capacity to function on the mental plane. Well, maybe it's just telling us that because we are now given meditative technique and told something about its objectives, that only recently have we achieved the capacity to function on the mental plane. The Atlantean age lasted a long time. It was primarily an emotional age for the majority, much longer than the Aryan root race has lasted so far. So we certainly are used to emotional response. And we live in kind of an astral Buddhic solar system anyway, we are told. And the emotional body for the man is the only undivided body, so it has great strength, probably because of the condition of the greater lords in whom we live and move and have our being and have our astral body as well. So maybe our mentality is not such a recent acquisition, relatively. Down the great cycle upon the wheel of rebirth, the idea of the solar angel is attaining definite concretion. Well, maybe, you know, are we the idea of the solar angel as it consults with the monad which has sent us forth in extension? Let's see. A Treatise on Cosmic Fire, page 1024. These two books are going hand in hand, of course. But we're getting a bit more individual and personal here in this book, A Treatise on White Magic. Each life sees the initial purpose clarified, and time is literally the length of a thought. Okay, well, that is a great statement, and one which is going to necessitate pondering. I know, you know, sometimes I think that time is literally the length of a self-perception, a deity's or any creator's self-perception. But there's much to bring together here. By thought, do we mean an observation, a perception? Or do we mean that everything that is occurring within a universe is timed according to the length of the thought? Every emanation is in a way a thought, and the universal logos in all of its ramification attends to certain thoughts for a longer time or shorter time than it does others. So there's relativity in the question of time. How long, or let's say, for what duration is the thought entertained? In other words, say we have two thoughts. One of them continues and another disappears. The one that disappears, we say, is shorter and lasts for a shorter length of time than the one that continues. But we have constantly to be comparing the appearing and disappearing of thoughts in order to measure their relative time. I've often questioned myself and wondered whether the duration of a universe is a fixed duration relative to measurements taken within the great breath. I mean, you know, the eternal parent slept for seven eternities. Is this an invariable fixed period, or is every universal deity, given the opportunity, since time is infinite, to work through completely the archetype, which must be achieved in manifestation? In other words, does it make any difference how long a universe may last? All durations of universes are ultimately, when compared with absolute infinity, they are infinitesimals, and maybe they are all absolute infinitesimals, regardless of their relative definite duration. Well, you know, we're not going to know the answer to that immediately. Does every universe last relatively when measured against the non-universal span or the span of another universe? Does it last exactly the same amount of time, so that if there is incompleteness, that universe is taken out of objectivity before completeness can be achieved? Or since in a way there is an eternal duration all the time in the world, whether that logos is given the chance to work through the fulfillment of the archetype before universal pralaya sets in, the greatest of the days be with us. Well, these are, you know, far-ranging speculative thoughts, and we might say, well, what has this to do with me, the tiny little human being? But, you know, in a way, we are a monadic extension, and we are not a tiny little human being. We are only temporarily occupying and expressing through this very truncated or confined form. And one day, as we approach a realization of what our essence is, the form through which we manifest will become larger and larger, and our days of having been a human being will seem long ago and far away, even though others may be rising through that state, we somehow have to achieve the universalization of identity. And that's just a beginning, because the universe is just an infinitesimal, and then there's the whole thing, the absolute infinitude. We somehow, and one day, and I guess we always do, after the great pralaya, realize that we are the absolute deity in the post-universal and post-pralayic and pre-universal state. There are so many realizations of identity which lie before us. And, you know, they are synthesized often by the statement, I am the one. And any true magician has to be able to say that in Leo, you know, I am the one being. Just the way you would say, I am the light of the world in Taurus, you know, or I overcome all illusion in Scorpio. Or I serve all in Aquarius. There are great mantras which represent states of consciousness, and we have not just to say them. As we say them, they have to be true of us. So the we are, in a way, the idea of the solar angel, but the solar angel is taking its cue from the monadic intention. I mean, in a way, all monads are one, but from an earlier perspective, the monad and monadic vehicle of the solar angel is different and more advanced than the monad of the man. And the solar angel steps in and says, you know, what can I do for you? It says to the human monad, to make possible the expression of your archetypal intention. Now, that's a real act of sacrifice. And as long as we want something for ourselves more than we want to sacrifice those somethings for the sake of others and for their achievement, we still have a long way to go. We really are, you know, as vast as it may seem to us, we are dealing with the ABCs of the great science and art of occultism. Okay, this same basic truth underlies the creation of all forms. The same process, really. You know, he's dealt with God, with the solar angel, with the human being. And now he's saying the creation of all forms on the physical plane, whether it is a thought form embodying the urgent desire of a man for selfish acquisition, a selfish thought, in other words, or that thought form which we call a group or an organization and which is animated by the unselfish purpose and embodies some disciple's mode of helping humanity, you know, let's just say creating an organization, or better, an organism. Let's say that Master DK has a lot to do with the Red Cross, we've been told, and it's charitable and medical services, and he stands in a way behind it. So there is a group, organization or organism, which is animated by unselfish purpose, ideally, and embodies this, that particular disciple's mode of helping humanity. That disciple is a master, but through the Red Cross, he is helping humanity, and he considers humanity first and not the national status of the combatants, let's say, in a war or in some emergency situation. Human beings are considered first as human beings. So it's truly a humanitarian service. Okay, so what underlies group work regarding a group as an entity If a group could appreciate the power of this fact and recognize its opportunity, it could, by its one-pointed fixity of purpose and its focused attention to the spiritual objective, perform miracles in salvaging the world. Gosh, it's almost like an invocation to the Red Cross. But of course, one group which does this is the spiritual hierarchy of our planet. And it will be, in a sense, performing miracles regarding the salvaging of humanity and the various kingdoms of nature and of our planet. I here appeal to all who read these words to re-consecrate themselves. You know, these exhortations come every once in a while from a very devoted master, to reconsecrate themselves and to recognize the opportunity they have of an united effort towards world usefulness. Okay. It looks like we're beginning a new section, possibly here. Well, you know, none of this is easy, and, you know, it's worthwhile to stop and ponder for far longer periods than we've been able to do. But if such material is ever used in study groups and in some class form, then maybe there will be more time to stop and to ponder. So we've been dealing with all kinds of creative thinkers, from the solar logos on down in a solar system. So let's just say we have been dealing with a number of types of creative thinkers, from a solar logos down to the human being, and maybe something below, but it must be individualized and self-conscious. And we're dealing with the magical process here and the kinds of recognitions of the past of the cooperating workers, and finally, what was that third one? I should remember, but yeah, the objective in one's own mind. All of these exist for individualized, self-conscious, creative thinkers, those of immense scope and those of lesser scope. Now, we're about to get into, what does he say? It might here be of use if I expressed quite simply the requirements needed to bring about the manifestation of individual spiritual purpose and of group spiritual purpose. And I think that what I can do is basically stop, and maybe, you know, while this is converting, I can take up, we're on page 557, and we seem to be starting at, what is it, 552, yeah. So, 552 to 557, and I think this will be the end of part five, and if I have time, before some other pressing matters, I will continue. I'm well aware of my own incapacity, really, to represent the master in any significant degree of accuracy, but I think what I can do here is make bridges and indicate relationships. So this is the end of number five, and we are from 552 to 557, and it's rule 13, and it's 13-2 in two parts. Well, at least I stopped at the hour point, and beginning then with a video commentary on this, number six, and we'll start from 557, after perhaps a little pause that I will make, and it's rule 13, and it's going to be 13.3, 13.3, in how many parts, I don't know. Sometimes I'm simply reduced to doing a one-part, one-hour program. See, when you try to save, what can happen? Yes, do I want to save that? You bet I do. And will it give me the opportunity? Maybe. Hopefully. Anyway, that's not your problem. That's my problem. Yep, it could become your problem. Well, I'll tell you what I'm going to do. I'm going to sign off here and see if I can solve this issue. And then go on to number six. So we'll be continuing, and hopefully before I have to go to the United States, I'll be able to deal with how many pages are left here in this document, maybe 60, 70 pages. Let's see what can be done. Okay, lots of love, many blessings, study hard, assimilate, apply, you know, all the usual. We just have to do it.